I found a wonderful example on the weblog of Clemens Vasters.
Yes.
And this is what he said. I'll actually even read a little bit of it because I think it paints a wonderful picture. He's talking about a custom application that he built to kind of synchronize his television from Germany.
Yeah, it's kind of a sling box that he wrote himself.
So this is what he said. I did this thing so that I have full media center access to live and recorded TV, along with electronic program guide for 45 channels in Germany. And then he says, the work of getting the connectivity right, dynamic DNS, port mappings, firewall holes, dealing with the bandwidth constraints and shielding, this all against unwanted access. All of this was ridiculously complicated. But he goes on to say, it's been an immediate and huge improvement of the quality of life for us. It's enabled by the internet, and it has not much to do with the web, let alone Web 2.0, except that my program guide app happens to be an Ajax application today. And then he concludes with, using BizTalk services would throw out a whole lot of complexity that I had to deal with myself, especially on the access control, identity, connectivity, and discoverability fronts. So, given that the app that he's talking about there is, in, if you think about it, a model for a whole lot of different things
Oh, yeah.
that people are going to want to do, and I mean, he raises the issues of, as he said, sort of identity, security. There's firewall traversal. There's pushing a lot of data around, and there's integration of various kinds of services. How would you explain to someone your notion of what BizTalk services will do to make something like that much more achievable by somebody who's less insanely talented than than Clemens is?
Well, Clemens is insanely talented, and so he single-handedly attacked a space that many startups go after with multiple people. So it's this huge economic barrier to people building connected cross-organization, cross-device applications. If you think about some of the biggest internet successes, things like Slingbox or Skype or the new Juiced technologies, they're all built on this principle that somehow we're going to get a bunch of different pieces of software kind of all around the world to communicate in a safe, secure, connected way. And these are well-funded organizations with a lot of technical experience. In a way, it just is a testament to how smart Clemens is that this one guy went out and started building all of that infrastructure. And probably even more remarkable is that he pulled it off.
I have a lot of faith in his abilities, and so that doesn't amaze me. But the question is, how specifically are you going to democratize that kind of scenario so that the mortals among us will be able to approach it?
We do this demo all the time for developers, where we take an existing application built on WCF, one that developers that are new to it, even novice programmers, can kind of write in their sleep. And the Echo example is probably the easiest one. You've got a client and server set up, you take the sample out of the WCF, Indigo programming guides, and you just code it up, and it just kind of works. Now you say, huh, imagine if we wanted to do this thing where both sides of that app are in different organizations. And there's firewalls and NATs in between, and we need security and all that kind of stuff. And you say, how long would that take you guys to do it? And pretty much universally, we get laughed at when we propose that. That just the thought of going through the internal processes around getting such a thing approved, or even if it wasn't in a corporate environment, imagine it was just in home environments, working with the firewalls and getting the connectivity and keeping it running and all those things that Clemens talked about, people who know what they're talking about laugh at you because why would you even bother trying? It's such a pain in the neck. And even if you did succeed, your ability to keep it running day after day, a big pain. And they have to have a staff of people that keep the firewalls configured and all the rest. So we ask that question in these audiences and we say, okay, so let's actually go make it happen. And we go in and we change the config to, instead of using the local binding, to now work with BizTalk services. So notice we haven't changed a single line of code. We just go in and change the config. This is what an administrator might do when they deploy the app.
Yep.
And then we run it, and it works. And the developers cheer, and they kind of look at it and think it's magic. In a sense, it's almost inconceivable that without modifying a line of code, you could make this thing work in this radically different way. And the code pathway is so amazingly different that that's kind of one of the reasons that it seems like magic. So, for example, in the local case, it's not secured. It's just sending messages, and everything's sort of open, and you're behind the firewall, and so that's okay. When we change the binding and we say, hey, we're going to go do this cross-organization thing, one of the things that we do is our BizTalk services are configured with a security policy that requires stronger credentials, because you don't want just arbitrary things flowing into your corporation. You want to make sure you're conforming to good hygiene in these cases, that only authorized users are able to do it and so on. So we conform to the existing patterns that people use with good mail or IAMs or other kinds of things. But we use even stronger credentials. And so when you run the app, instead of it just working, credential pickers pop up. So in this particular case, because we're configured that way, CardSpace pops up, but it's fully configurable. You could do other things.
Okay.
So the pathway is so different that instead of the message going from point to point, it talks to this intermediary, it gets authorized, the intermediary sets up these channels, high-performance communication channels are set up, and the thing just kind of works.
And it sounds to me like this is a classic demonstration of the power of intermediation. You know, I think one of the first times, maybe the first time that I met you out at Microsoft, you were talking to us about Indigo, and I observed that, I think around that time, the term service fabric was
yep.
just coming into vogue, and we looked at what you folks were building, and I remember saying, this looks like it'd be a great foundation, a great substrate on which to construct a services fabric.
And that's and the idea.
That's essentially what it sounds like you're doing. So kind of run through, what are the components of that, right? What are the pieces of infrastructure in terms of identity, in terms of connectivity, in terms of routing, in terms of policy-driven kinds of things?
Before I kind of start with the technical pieces, I kind of have to take just a tiny step back and describe why it's possible.
Sure.
Like, why the magic actually can work. Maybe the easiest way to explain it is an analogy I often give people, which is the file system. You know, in the early days when we were out inventing computers and operating systems, developers had to program differently for different storage systems. I mean, in the really early days, you had to kind of understand that you were on a drum memory. And
you're not that old, come on.
No, I wasn't that old. But people actually thought about these things. And then there were sectors, and people used to store these things. And then some very smart people came up with this idea that, hey, why don't we pretend that this thing is a file system? And they invented this idea of files. And the idea of a file is made up, right? There's no such thing as a file. There's sectors on a disk that are magnetic domains, and heads move around, and a whole big layer of software creates this illusion.
Actually, lots of layers.
Lots of layers. And the thing that's so powerful about this file system illusion, right? First we invent the files, and then we invent this notion of directories and so on, is that we can have incredibly different implementations behind that illusion. I mean, we can put it on compact flash memory, which uses solid-state electronics, or we could put it on a local hard disk, which is attached to my computer, or we could even do a LAN-based network-attached storage model. And from a programmatic standpoint, I just think of this thing as directories and files.
Yep.
And the plumbing is so radically different, and in some cases so complex, that there's very few people who have really taken a look at all of the details that go on in some of these things. And yet, from a developer standpoint, it all just kind of works now. And then we did this other amazing thing, which is we built these user interfaces on top of it, so that, you know, we're dragging around pictures, these icons of files, and dropping them into folders, and it all just kind of happens. So what the big thing that we did in WCF is we invented this abstraction of channels and messages, and we said that's the layer that we're going to work at. And we're not going to be down twiddling the individual bits or packets or setting up the individual TCP/IP connections or UDP packets. We'll talk about messages, and we'll construct this in such a way that we can layer and compose these channels in interesting ways. And so we can take a TCP transport and we can layer, for example, a reliable messaging system on top of that. And then above it, it still looks just like a channel. Mm-hmm. It's just this communication abstraction where I'm sending messages, and it just seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
And we integrated security into that and a bunch of other things. Well, we're employing that abstraction in this world. So what goes on kind of under the hood is when we first write our program, we use the channel abstraction and we talk locally. Then through this config change, what we do is we pop in a different implementation of that same abstraction, which is now plumbed in a pretty different way. So it provides the same abstraction, but instead of making a direct connection to the other side based on local network addresses, the first thing it does is it contacts our naming system up in this internet service bus that is BizTalk Services. And it uses an abstracted name to find a resource. And this is kind of the first stage in that fabric world, which is we need an indirection in the naming system so that we're not binding individual machines to names, but we're providing a methodology to create a name up in the cloud, and then anybody that has the appropriate permissions can attach themselves to that name and either send or listen.
And how do we want to think about the scope of that namespace? Do we want to think of it as being global and singly rooted? Do we want to think of it as being global and multiply rooted? Do we want to think of it as being enterprise level?
It's global and multiply rooted.
Okay.
And that is a pretty radical change in the kind of naming that we've historically had on the internet. The other thing is that it is URL-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so in internet naming, we have this first part, which is the DNS name, and then we have this URL path. And normally the URL paths are interpreted by the individual computer, and the DNS name is used to identify the particular node that's going to end up processing it. And it may be a collection of nodes, and we use things like NLBs to network load balancers to spread an IP address across a bunch of machines.
Yep.
But logically, we have these kind of two-part names. And there's a pretty tight binding between the DNS name and an expectation that we're going to reach a set of machines that can go handle that, and it's all sort of hierarchically constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can do some things with CNAMEs and other things where we kind of cross-connect those systems, and that's certainly doable. Akamai is a good example of this, where their same set of machines might be serving many different domains.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing that on a URL namespace. And so we can have multiple DNS routes. So GE.com could be the beginning of one of these naming, federated naming systems. Connect.biztalk.net is another one.
Mm-hmm.
You could set up your own. And then that string, that first DNS name, now points to a URL path. And any part of that URL path can now be distributed. And there can be multiple machines listening at any point in that URL path. And here's the next kind of most important thing. They can be located anywhere. They can be located behind NATs or firewalls or other kinds of things. So in a sense, what we've done by creating this indirection is we've eliminated the connectivity issues. Now, that sometimes scares the pants off of people. Oh, my God, everything's connected. But at the same time that we're providing this universal connectivity, we're also saying that there is a security model that only those that are authenticated have access to it. And so we think down the road, as people become more comfortable with these concepts, what they'll want to do is they'll want to put pretty much anything that they have into a federated namespace. By putting it into the federated namespace, we don't mean that anybody can connect to it, but there is at least the ability to connect to it. So if I've got some corporate server that has some corporate data, I'd like to have a stable name that I could use from anywhere on the planet to be able to get access to that, assuming I have access. And that's what we've created.
Okay, so operationally, how does this play out in terms of, you mentioned there's a root, let's say, at GE.com. There's obviously going to be an important one that's operated by Microsoft. What's the relationship between those entities in this fabric?
Well, what goes on is very much a process like DNS, which is you take that name, you send a message off to a machine, and that machine's going to resolve the name. And there's a registration process that computers can use to attach themselves to those names. And so it's not a very complex system. The complexity, if there is any, is kind of in the infrastructure, where we make sure that that stuff can work whether you're on a mobile device or behind a NAT or a firewall, and we make it work in a set of connectivity patterns that are a little richer than the typical connectivity patterns we have with existing naming structures.
So you've talked about this as being a hosted scenario, but you don't simply mean hosted by a Microsoft business unit.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
One of the things that we talk about a lot is that anything that we're doing out with our BizTalk services, a company can buy our software products and host them themselves. So if a developer wanted to create their own namespace, that's a pretty easy thing to go do as well.
And will Microsoft be operating the registry, however, for this stuff?
No, it's a federated registry.
It's a federated registry, okay.
Yeah, so you use DNS as your bootstrap. That gets you to a machine, and then you send just a series of messages to that machine, or that could be a collection of machines, logically that node, that then resolves it to other nodes that are going to process the messages.
Okay.
So we're just applying that same abstraction that's inside of Indigo, kind of recursively, but now applying it to the naming problem. And let me just add one last point, which is once we've got one of these names, now there's a bunch of different patterns you can send messages to it. You can send a message to all the nodes that are listening to that. That's the multicast pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You can also do the anycast pattern, which is send the message to one of the nodes that is listening at that name. And so those are, for example, different communication patterns.
Kind of a pub-sub pattern available, right?
You've got a pub-sub pattern available, or you've got the equivalent of an NLB-style pattern,
mm-hmm.
or a distributed DNS-style pattern.
Okay. So this is a WCF-based kind of an internet in some sense. But being that it's WCF, all of the usual points of integration exist, right? So you could have, you know, REST kinds of services, and you could have WS Star kinds of services going into and out of this fabric.
Yep, that it is not in any way isolated to Microsoft technologies. So if you wanted to hook up with PHP or Firefox browser, all of that, all of these technologies connect into that internet service bus in the same way.
Right. So talk a little bit then about how, to the extent that some of these kinds of transports and these kinds of communication patterns that we see on the open web today, to the extent that those begin to happen in this environment, talk a little bit about how they become available for intermediation, how they become exposed to things like declarative assertion of security policies and things like that.
A good example of this is a little project that one of our developers actually worked on this weekend. He put it together, and in a sense he was surprised at how capable the resulting solution was. And here was the idea. He used the relay to connect to an ASP.NET implementation that was running on a local machine behind a firewall.
Okay.
And what he did was he took the incoming requests from the BizTalk services, and he translated that into a WCF request that was transmitted through the NAT firewall, and then hit the local machine where it was passed on to ASP.NET, and then the web page was passed back.
So he was able to publish an ASP.NET service off of a local machine into this federation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So here's what he was able to do. He took an ASP.NET app, ran it on his home machine,
mm-hmm.
and then without having to go do any dynamic DNS, without having to do any additional coding, with just simply a configuration change, he was able to create a URL out on the public internet that people could connect to.
Mm-hmm.
And he happened to do this on a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other amazing things that he discovered about this is that as he moved his laptop around, the connection continued to reestablish itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he came to work, it would work. If he was at home, it would work. The app would reconnect when it discovered that the connection went down, and it would connect into a new point. And all of a sudden, he had connectivity to this ASP.NET app in a way that was beyond kind of his initial expectations about how connected the application could be.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that same comment that Clemens made, which was, wow, there was a lot of work for me to get all of this infrastructure and plumbing to work with his application, getting the dynamic DNS set up, getting the servers in the right place, punching the right holes in the firewalls. And again, the experience of the developer in this case was, huh, that's weird. Everything now just seems to work. And so what we've done is, in a sense, we've packaged up Clemens Vasters into a DLL. And he's always on the job. He's always reconnecting and refiddling with the connections. And, you know, it's Clemens Vasters in a box.
So what's the story? One of the interesting things in the peer-to-peer world is always the case where you're able to actually bypass the relay and do something more optimal. So with Skype, for example, you know, like I discovered recently, because I hadn't used Skype in a long time, if you want to record a call, you want to not be going through the relay. You want to be able, you know, if you can possibly open up a port on your net, you want to do that and establish a direct connection between the two communicating hosts. Is there that sort of an optimization possible with this?
Yeah, there's a property on the relay binding called hybrid.
Okay.
Just turn that on. And it'll do the following. First, it'll enumerate the network card, and it'll use the local names, and it'll attempt to establish a local LAN WAN connection.
Okay.
So, you know, using standard network transports. If it can't do that, then it'll go first establish connection with a relay, and then it will attempt to use some sophisticated TCP/IP NAT firewall traversal techniques. Again, following the well-established patterns of the products like IM and Goodmail and other kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
or Skype is another example. It's a secure pattern. They're not sort of allowing arbitrary connections in from outside the internet. It establishes that pattern, and then if it can, it will create a direct connection. We're actually using a pretty sophisticated technique that's related to some innovative work coming out of organizations like MIT and Cornell for TCP traversal as opposed to UDP traversal.
Quite the black art, huh?
It turns out it is quite a black art because you need to do some things around port prediction on the outbound side. And, you know, I think as we work more with NAT firewall vendors, we can make this stuff easier for folks. But right now, there's a Clemens Vasters in the box working on that stuff for you.
So let's go back to your developer's example, because that's a very nice one, and kind of talk through how it is that, assuming that there is a declarative security policy for the organization,
yep.
How that gets applied to this connection.
Okay, so security really has kind of two parts in this world. And I tend to like to use the term identity and access control instead of security, because security can mean so many different things. It can mean virus protection and other kinds of things. And in particular, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to make sure that we know who's connecting and make decisions about whether or not that access is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to isolate it to that part of the discussion. So within that framework where we're creating these connections, there are really two parts to the connectivity. There's the end application, the service itself, which is going to receive messages and then needs to make a decision about whether or not that's authorized.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the infrastructure level capabilities, the relay, the BizTalk services relay, which is also making a set of decisions about whether or not to forward those messages along. And so at the end application, we follow completely the existing WCF model, which is fully declarative, identity and access control, policy-driven stuff. So you can go into the configs and you can say, for example, I require two-factor auth, or I require integration with Kerberos, or any number of different kinds of mechanisms that you could use to authenticate the incoming request.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no change in the model there, and that should be pretty familiar to people. But it's one of the richest systems out there. It in this policy-driven way, we can decide whether we want to use certs or Kerberos or username and password, a bunch of different mechanisms. And again, because of the magic of the abstraction, largely the programming model is consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So what we then did was we applied that same technology up or down in the stack, if you will, to the infrastructure layer. And the relay now has the same kind of policies. And so what we did is up at identity.biztalk.net, we said, hey, in order to traverse the relay, you're going to need to have an authenticated account. And the way we said you have an authenticated account is you went and you registered, created an account with BizTalk Services, and we checked to make sure that you had a legitimate account. And that's where we were in our R7 release, just prior to our last release. And so you had a pretty great story where you could enforce as rigorous a security policy as you wanted, but you were enforcing it on your application in your node, and the relay was just providing basic identity into that framework so that it was making sure that accounts were created, but it wasn't doing any access control management.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key new features that we added in the latest release of BizTalk Services, in the R9 release, on the R8 release that's up there now, is we added, and it's very simple in the first release, the ability to place access control restrictions on the forwarding of the messages through the infrastructure.
Hmm.
So what that enables a developer to do is to say, hey, Mr. Hosted Service, and that could be Microsoft today or others in the future, we would like the infrastructure to support doing the access control check out in the infrastructure. So mm-hmm. don't even use any of my bandwidth down to my machines. Don't even let it get near our organization unless they have these characteristics.
Yeah.
So today you can isolate it to individuals, but as we've talked about on our blogs, we're using the rich claims-based access control model that is built into Indigo to provide for a very rich set of capabilities. So you can do it based on attributes, you can have authorization tokens, you can use rollback, role-based access control, you can use SAML-based attribute mechanisms. All of those things will be supported in fairly short order.
So compare the case where, well, what you just described, which is kind of looking down into the organization, you have some internal resource that you want to publish to the net, in effect, make available, and it could be, you know, you mentioned a local ASP.NET app, but actually it could be all kinds of things.
Right? Yep.
Could be a local anything. Then there's this interesting different case that you've also talked about a lot, which is the organization-to-organization bridge.
Yep.
Right? So in that case, in order to have this second layer of access control that you've discussed, it sounds like both parties would have to, I think it sounds like in this scenario, would have to have accounts on the same, I don't know what you want to call it, hub or relay, right?
Well, because we use federation and we're using that claims-based access control, those claims can come from anywhere.
Okay.
So, for example, let's go back to maybe a simple cross-corporate example. Imagine that you had an engineer at General Electric who was working on an aircraft engine and wanted to share data with Boeing engineers. They might decide that this is a legitimate thing to do. So they made their application. They could use this binding. They would go consult their corporate IT organization and discover what the kind of policies around this stuff are. And they might say, look, the only people we trust are from Boeing to come through here. And they could hand them a policy, a configuration that would enforce that requirement at the local site. And then they could say, look, in addition, we just want to be extra safe. We don't even want any messages coming into the organization unless they originated in Boeing.
Yeah.
So in addition, what we could do is we're going to place a Boeing attribute requirement on any URLs that are going to be associated with this application. And so you could go up to the BizTalk services and you could say,
okay,
Boeing employee issued by Boeing.com is required, gives you the ability to send messages.
Okay.
And then now we've got this kind of two-level capability. Now, you could mix this up. You could say, look, I only want Boeing employees to be able to send messages, and we're going to require two-factor auth. So we're going to actually put an additional attribute that says something about that it has to be a smart card validated Boeing credential.
Okay.
We'll put that on the up at BizTalk services. And then down in the particular application, we're going to say Joe at Boeing is the only engineer. So we could do the individual access control checks at the application layer and then delegate to the infrastructure the ability to provide the top level only from these organizations.
And we've also said, though, that this infrastructure is potentially a federation.
It could be federated itself,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so in that case, where does the config live?
In the case where I'm establishing a listener at, say, BizTalk services,
yeah,
then where I establish the listener, whatever hub that happens to be,
yes,
will do the enforcement.
Okay.
So if GE had a hub and Boeing had a hub, the GE guys obviously would use the GE namespace, and they would do the enforcement at the GE hub. And then if Boeing wanted to publish applications, they might use the Boeing hub and publish in their namespaces. And the great thing is if the companies are hosting those hubs themselves, then they can put their configuration in there.
Or in there can be cases where two organizations will agree to use some third party, yeah, or some other. Yeah, yeah, okay. Okay, and in that case, they just, as customers of that service, they have some administrative interface that enables them to go in and declare these policies.
The system's so flexible that in some regards it sounds complicated, but really the model is so straightforward, which is wherever I put the name, I put a policy, and that policy can work in a federated way. So if GE's got the hub, they set their policy, and they can say, we'll accept credentials that are two-factor credentials issued by Boeing.
Okay.
And Boeing's identity provider issues SAML tokens, as an example, that has the appropriate attributes. And if those SAML tokens accompany the message, then the GE hub will let it through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a pretty simple abstraction.
Extremely general.
It's extremely general. Yeah, so it's really, in a sense, it's kind of like the Swiss Army knife. If you want to do it, you certainly can. And there are a fair number of knobs that you can set. So we think one of the things that will help people a lot is to put templates up there that show examples of different kinds of configurations that developers can just start with.
Right. So how do you see this playing out from a business perspective for Microsoft? I mean, there's a combination of software plus services here, like we talk about a lot,
yeah.
Right? It goes both ways.
The thing that we've been talking about is this idea that whatever we're doing up there in our services infrastructure, any organization can purchase these servers and do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the existing software business model, still viable, doesn't go away. We do think that there are a set of scenarios where it's nice to be able to use this infrastructure without having to go set it up yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a developer and I just want to get, like Clements Vasters, I don't want to hire a whole IT organization to go run one of these things. So I might want to turn to a hoster that provides the same set of capabilities. And the great thing about the model is I can switch back and forth. If I start in the hosted environment and I want to run it locally, I have that option.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to run it locally and then I need additional capacity, I can turn to a hoster in order to add additional capacity. And the system is quite fluid moving between those things.
So there's issues of capacity. There are also potentially some issues of latency, colocation benefits, things like that, right?
Exactly. It really is going to be a decision about by the IT organization about the latency issues, the cost, how they want to manage the costs, and so on. Now, when we host it, obviously we'll incur certain operational costs associated with machines and running the network I/O and so on. And so we'll want to have a mechanism to provide that, to recover those costs back to the users. But our goal on these things is not to differentiate our offering from other people's offerings because we host the software. it should be the case that Microsoft competes on an equal basis with the other hosters, and we use our software, and it would be largely an equivalent model. One other kind of quick observation is that in many regards, our motivations differ from some of the other providers. Like, just take Amazon's queuing service, perhaps, as an example. In the model that we describe with this hybrid connection, because we've got software running both up in the cloud as well as on the edge nodes, one of the great things we can do is we can create a network shortcut, as we described earlier, so that the two endpoints can talk directly to each other.
Right.
And in that scenario, what ends up happening is that we don't see any traffic up on our network. All we did was we provided a very simple name capability, and then the two applications ended up speaking to each other.
Yes.
Using the network bandwidth that the company has already allocated to themselves. So they don't incur any cost associated with running in that kind of environment, that we can use the smarts in the clients and on our servers to actually reduce our overall operating costs. And so we think that that kind of operating benefit should result in overall lower costs to organizations.
Interesting point. So what do you think about the possibility, I mean, you back to your developer's example, it wasn't, strictly speaking, a desktop application. It was a locally based web server. But, I mean, one of the things that's beginning to be true is that there are starting to be significant numbers of end-user machines out in the world with WCF on them, right? So, you know, what do you see the potential there possibly being in terms of a kind of a, you know, if you will, a peer-to-peer renaissance, right, where interesting things can happen kind of straight to the desktop and can inherit these capabilities?
You've hit on, I think, what is a vision that many of us in the industry share, which is we'd like to reduce the barrier, whether it be the economic barriers or the development overhead barriers, to being able to connect together our machines, our solutions, and so on. And the industry's seen a big transition to a hosted world because that was one of the easiest ways to get kind of universal connectivity.
Yes.
So if a big organization with a whole bunch of high priests of IT were out there running the servers for you, well, then we didn't have to get our machine to go be able to do that. But, you know, the pendulum's always swinging back and forth on this thing. We've both been in the industry for long enough to have seen this, that sometimes I might just want to put those things on my machine, and if it were easy enough, wouldn't that be a great model? Why do I want to be beholden to some organization that's capturing my data? Maybe I want to have more privacy, or if it's easy enough, why not just drop it on my machine? Now, there's certain benefits that I might have for sometimes moving it out to the cloud, but we think that should be a decision that you make after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Why should you have to make those kind of decisions up front?
Mm-hmm.
You should build your application to a consistent abstraction and then decide where you want the dial as the demands on the application change. If I'm just trying to do a quick video share with my friends, why do I have to go create a new space? Why can't I simply say, here's the URL?
Yes.
And have that URL be stable?
Yes.
So this is all kind of moving in that direction, and I think that lots of people have different ways that they're approaching those kind of challenges, and we hope that the one we're creating has compelling to people and that they'll enjoy having these capabilities in the .NET framework.
But this is a huge pet project for you, right? This is something you've wanted to do for a long time.
Well, it's kind of interesting. As you talked about, we've been talking about these ideas for a long time, and WCF was, I don't think, the end. WCF was kind of the first step in a pretty long process, and
yeah.
This is just another step along that path to create these things.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate this very much.
Okay, take care, John.
All right, take care.